Ted Hoggard and I are going to teach it together. Of course, everybody knows Ted has that awful schedule where he is able to be here for 2 weeks and then he misses a week and he's able to be here for 2 weeks. So hopefully between the two of us, we'll be able to kind of tag team the Book of Romans. If you're interested, the material that Ted and I have decided to use is a book that was written by L.A. Mott, and I don't know what L.A. stands for. He was a teacher at Florida College and taught the Book of Romans in a one-quarter class. So his Romans class lasted one quarter. That's 13 weeks. However, his 13 weeks were made up of 3 one-hour class periods each week. Ours are not. It was a three-credit course, and a three-credit course means it meets 3 times a week for 1 hour. So we will attempt to go through this in 13 weeks. It may be that as we get started, we'll decide to extend it out to maybe 26 weeks because I don't want to give it short shrift and just not give it the attention that it deserves. And some of it is a little bit hard to keep straight, just to keep the flow of the book straight. So if you're interested in getting a hold of the book that we are reading, it's right there for you on the screen. It's the first slide that I sent you. That's the ISBN the number that's up there at the top. If you're ordering it, the best way to order it is by ISBN number. It's also available as an audiobook. It's available it's available for Kindle. And that's the way I do it. I have my Kindle and I download it to my Kindle. And the advantage is that I can make the print as big as I want it. So, and on top of that, it's cheaper. It only costs like $12 to get it on Kindle. Now you're going to be out $140 for the Kindle, but that is something that you have and you just keep using it. It's like a computer. Mine's right here, not very big. I also bought the LaGard Smith's Chronological Bible for my Kindle, and Kim and I can both read it. It's really cool. So if you're interested, you can get it in paperback, hardback, you can get it for Kindle, you can get it as an audiobook. Tonight we're going to start with some background information, try to kind of get us ready to talk about the Book of Romans. Ted will have the next 2 weeks. The background information that we're going to talk about is the date of the writing. I think it's pretty much generally assumed by everybody that it was written by the Apostle Paul. So we're not going to spend any time talking about who wrote the book. That's pretty obvious. We're going to talk about a little bit about the congregations that I think existed in Rome. I don't think that all of the Christians in Rome met together in one congregation, and we'll talk a little bit about why I think that's the case. And then we'll talk a little bit about Paul's intention in writing this book. If you understand the intention, then you can understand the flow of his argument. Something like 1 Corinthians, for example, was written to deal with problems that existed within the church and they were manifesting themselves in their worship. The book of Hebrews was a book that was written, in my mind, to help Jewish Christians, those who were Jews that had become Christians, to be able to deal with what their Jewish parents would say at Hanukkah dinner. Okay? Because they had to have a way to respond to the arguments that the Jews would make. And so I think that's why the book of Hebrews was written. The book of Romans, on the other hand, is written, I think, to talk about the Christian's walk. And it's there's not much in the book of Romans that deals with what happens in the worship. That a lot of that is in 1 Corinthians. There's not a lot in Hebrews that deals with what happens in worship. There's not hardly anything in the book of Romans that deals with what happens in worship. Understand that Christianity is more all-embracing than just what happens in a place where we come together for worship. We come together to take the Lord's Supper, and we sing, and we pray. There's a whole lot more to Christianity than just that. So I want to kind of talk a little bit about the focus. Let's talk about when it was written, probably in the mid-50s, maybe as late as 59, but most scholars think that it was probably written around 54, 55. And the only way to know that is to look at the people that Paul mentions and where he had been and where he was going. And we know roughly about when he arrived in some of these places. So we can kind of put that together and say it was probably written in the 50s. Now, where would that put this in terms of the development of the church? The church begins, on Pentecost, which would have been in about 30. When were the first Gentiles converted? No, not, you're talking the Gentiles, not Jews, right? So the Jews come in on Pentecost.
About 10 years
to get to Cornelius. So that puts Cornelius at about the year 40. And if this is written about the year 55, we're talking about a church that has embraced, for the most part, Jews and Gentiles. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't problems between Jews and Gentiles. And I don't think Paul really tries to address those difficulties as much as he tries to just lay out the gospel. He doesn't focus on the difficulties. He has been focused on them because, remember, he went to Jerusalem when there was that problem in Antioch, and the people had come from Jerusalem, Jews had come from Jerusalem and said to the Gentiles, you have to be circumcised. And Paul said, no, you don't have to be circumcised. That's not part of the gospel. And they said, well, the elders in Jerusalem sent us out to do this. And Paul had to go to Jerusalem, to his credit. And he said, he assembled the church and the elders. He said, did you send them out to do this? And they said, no. So that's about where we are. Let's read a little bit about the setting, what's happening to Paul as he's writing this book. And we're going to read a couple of places. Romans 1, and then he returns to this discussion in Romans 15. So Romans 1, beginning at verse 8, first, and by the way, I'm reading from the American Standard Translation. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, Romans 1 at verse 8, that your faith is proclaimed throughout the whole world. God is my witness, whom I serve in my spirit in the gospel of his Son, how unceasingly I make mention of you always in my prayers. Making request, if by any means, now at length, I may be prospered by the will of God to come unto you. For For I long to see you, that I may impart unto you some spiritual gift to the end that you may be established. That is, that I, with you, may be comforted in you, each of us by the other's faith, both yours and mine. I would not have you ignorant, brethren, that often I have to tell a bad story on myself. A friend of mine and I used to take the commas and put them in the wrong places in the biblical text. And this was one that we've messed with, where Paul says, I wouldn't have you ignorant, brethren. That's not the way it goes. But I have to be really careful when I read it to not read it that way. He said, I would not have you ignorant, brethren, that oftentimes I purposed to come unto you and was hindered hitherto, that I might have some fruit in you also, even as in the rest of the Gentiles. For I'm debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, to the wise and to the foolish. So, as much as in me is, I'm ready to preach the gospel to you also that are in Rome. Just as an aside, where did Paul, when he was first converted, where did he kind of think his ministry would be?
I think among the Jews.
Why would he think the Jews?
Because he was a Jew of Jews. He was a leader of the Jews. And he knew the Jewish system inside and out. But that's not what God had meant for
him. Right, right.
I suspect that was what his ministry was going to be.
Well, he even says that. He wanted to go to the Jews. And God said, no, go to the Gentiles. And that is a little surprising. God doesn't always look at things the way that we do. So he's wanted to come to Rome to see them, but he has not yet been to Rome. And he's writing this letter to them, hoping that he can one day come to Rome. So let's drop down to the 15th chapter. I myself also am, this is beginning at verse 14. I myself also am persuaded of you, my brethren, that you yourselves are full of goodness, filled with all knowledge, able also to admonish one another. But I wrote the more boldly unto you in some measure, as putting you again in remembrance, because of the grace that was given me of God, that I should be a minister of Jesus Christ to the Gentiles, ministering the gospel of God, that the offering up of the Gentiles might be made acceptable, being sanctified by the Holy Spirit. I have therefore my glorying in Christ Jesus in the things pertaining to God. I will not dare to speak of anything save those which Christ has wrought through me for the obedience of the Gentiles by word and deed, in the power of signs and wonders, in the power of the Holy Spirit, so that from Jerusalem and round about, even unto Elysium, I have fully preached the gospel of Christ, yet making it my aim so as to preach the gospel, not where Christ was already named, that I might not build upon another man's foundation, but as it is written, they shall see to whom no tidings of him came, and those who have not heard shall understand. Paul is reluctant, apparently, to go where the gospel already is known. He spent most of his preaching career going to places that hadn't heard the gospel, because there was no reason for him to go to places where the gospel was already known. So it's not that Paul is somehow diminishing the work that other people have done, nor is he diminishing the work that he was doing. He's just saying, we have to be strategic about this. We have to go where the gospel hasn't been, or we're not going to help the gospel spread. So that's what I think he's saying. Wherefore also I was hindered these many times from coming to you, but now having no more any place in these regions, and having these many years a longing to come to you, whensoever I go to Spain, for I hope to see you in my journey, and also to be brought on my way thitherward by you. First, in some measure, I shall have been satisfied with your company. But now I say, I go to Jerusalem, ministering to the saints. It hath been the good pleasure of Macedonia and Achaia to make certain contribution for the poor among the saints that are at Jerusalem. Yea, it hath been their good pleasure, and their debtors they are. Or if the Gentiles have been made partakers of their spiritual things, they owe it to them also to minister to them in carnal things. When, therefore, I have accomplished this and have sealed to them this fruit, I will go to you, or go by you unto Spain. And I know that when I come unto you, I shall come in the fullness of the blessing of Christ. Now I beseech you, brethren, by our Lord Jesus Christ and by the love of the Spirit, that you strive together with me in your prayers to God for me, that I may be delivered from them that are disobedient in Judea, that my ministration, which I have for Jerusalem, may be acceptable to the saints, that I may come to you in joy through the will of God, and together with you find rest. Now the God of peace be with you all. Amen. So what's Paul's ultimate goal?
Spread the gospel.
Spread the gospel. But where does he anticipate winding up? Yeah, in Spain.
Oh, Spain. Okay.
If you look at the work that Paul has done, this is a map showing his missionary journeys. He has spent a lot of time on the eastern side of the Mediterranean Sea. And that's where he has been preaching. He's been around in this area. He's gone up here into Greece. He's gone down to Cyprus. Now he's on his way to Jerusalem to take the funds that had been assembled by the churches in Macedonia to relieve the saints in the famine. And then he's going to go to Rome. Or he's going to attempt to go to Spain and go by Rome. Now, whether he ever got to Spain, we don't know. There are some that suggest that he eventually did go to Spain, that he was on trial in Jerusalem, in Rome, and was eventually released. There are others that say, no, he didn't ever get released from prison in Rome. He never made it to Spain. I don't know. But I know it was his intention to go to Spain. Now, when he writes this, he's going in the opposite direction. He's headed towards Jerusalem. So he has the long-term view in mind. Where has he been sort of headquartered? That's not the right word, but where did he go in and out from for the most part? Antioch? Jerusalem? Two other cities that he spent a long time in. Ephesus, Corinth. Okay. So he's been spending a lot of time over in this area. And I think it's safe to say that Rome is outside of where he has been. Okay.
My understanding is that most of the Roman Christians were Gentiles. There would have been some Jews probably, but most of them, is that correct? They were Greek?
They were probably Greeks. hang on to that thought. We'll get to it in just a minute. Okay? He's wanted to go to Rome for a long time. At this point, Rome is not what Rome eventually became in the Roman Catholic Church. Okay? If there was a headquarters in the church, you would probably have said it was Antioch. Yeah, Bill.
Yeah, this might be a little off the field, but I was curious. Some ways in the future, is there a reason the Roman Catholic Church arose in Rome rather than somewhere else?
Probably physical. All roads lead to Rome. It was the capital of the world at that time. And so most commerce traveled either to Rome or away from Rome. So it's not surprising that Rome assumed that position. Now, as the Roman Empire began to fall apart, the third century, it's replaced by Constantinople. And Constantinople, for the most part, supplanted Rome. And it became the headquarters or the preeminent city at that time. So you had the Eastern Roman Empire, capital was Constantinople. You had the Western Roman Empire, capital was Rome. But Rome is being besieged by the barbarians. And frankly, Rome is losing. They are in real trouble. Constantinople is far enough away that most of the commerce moved to Constantinople. Okay? In fact, in the 6th and 7th centuries, when the Roman church hierarchy began to exert itself and began to think of themselves as quote unquote, the mother church. There were a lot of people in Constantinople who said, no, you're wrong. There were two popes for a while. There was the pope in Rome and there was the pope in Constantinople. And eventually they separated. And you have the Eastern Orthodox Church that's headquartered in Constantinople. And you have the Roman Catholic Church today that traces its ancestry back to the city of Rome. So Paul wants to get there, and for the most part, what has happened is early in the second century, towards the end of the first century, early in the second century, there's tremendous persecution against the Romans, or against the Christians in Rome. It started with Nero, and it eventually wound up under Domitian in about the year 90. And many, many of the Christians that were in Rome had to leave. Now, where had they probably heard the gospel? Acts 2. A lot of them were in Jerusalem. This is before the persecution. There were Jews living all over the world, and they came back to Jerusalem for Pentecost, for the three holidays. So it's not surprising that most of the people that were originally converted in Jerusalem, well, we know that they were Jews and proselytes. So they went back home. That was probably the beginning of the church there. The Jews took the church to Jerusalem. Okay? Or to Rome. Just like they took the gospel throughout most of the world. The apostles, remember, stayed in Jerusalem. But there was this mass exodus of Christians out of Jerusalem by virtue of the persecutions, some initiated by the Jews, the case of Stephen, Paul, or Saul at that time, some initiated by the Romans. So you had Christians were moving around largely to escape persecution. And what that did in the long run was it meant that the church grew. And it began to multiply. I'm not sure that I want to say that I'm glad that they were persecuted. That would be foolish. But I am glad that when they were persecuted, they went everywhere they went, still teaching the gospel. They didn't let the persecution stop them. Yeah.
I say it this way, that God was able to use Satan's activity for good.
Okay. I think, this is just me, that Paul had met up with a lot of these Christians who had been forced out of Jerusalem and out of Rome by persecution. Two of the people that he ran into were Aquila and Priscilla. He met them over in Corinth, stayed with them. They were converted. And then I get the impression that they went back to Rome after a certain time. And you see in Acts, the 18th chapter, 18th and 19th chapters, you see the apostle working with Aquila and Priscilla. And then I think they went back to Rome. In the 16th chapter of Rome, you see them mentioned as being in Rome. We first met them in Corinth. Then the next time we meet them, they're in Rome. Now, I don't know whether Paul sent them ahead to Rome or how they got there. Maybe they just wanted to go back home. And the persecution had subsided a little bit after Nero. It took up again after during the time of Domitian. But whatever the case, they would have prepared the Romans for Paul to come there. He's not been there at this point. And in fact, when he got there, how did he get there? In chains. Okay. Paul, God told him, you're going to go to Rome. He said, okay, ready to go. Oh yeah, I forgot to tell you, you're going to be in chains when you go. So he gets to Rome. Now, a little bit about the congregations there. And I say congregations as opposed to a church in Rome, because I think the 16th chapter gives us some indication that there might have been different groups meeting in Rome. If you look at Acts 16 at verse 5, he talks about Aquila and Priscilla and the church that was in their house. And then in the 14th verse, he talks about different people and the group that was, well, as he says it, was with them. So I think that there were more than one congregation in Rome. I think there were multiple groups that were meeting in Rome. That wouldn't be surprising. If you know anything about second century, the churches began to own property in the second century, and it was eventually confiscated from them by the Roman authorities. It was the reason that we know that it had been confiscated was because when Constantine came to power he issued what's called the Edict of Constantine, and that returned the property to the churches. So I don't know what kinds of property they owned, but they apparently owned some property as a corporate body. Now, interestingly, the Romans had confiscated property that belonged to churches and property that belonged to individual Christians. The Edict of Constantine returned the property to the corporate churches, but didn't return the property to individual Christians. So apparently there was at least some ownership of property as early as the second century. Yeah, Bill.
I think it's in Acts, where it said that everybody gave their money and their lands and they had everything common. Wouldn't be at all surprised if that's a lot of that land came.
It could have. That's a good point. It could have. If you look at the history, what the history suggests is that there were a lot of Christians who didn't want their unbelieving children to inherit their property. So they gave it to the church. And that was kind of the genesis of property beginning to be owned by churches. And it does ring true. Churches tended to use that property that had been given as hospitals, as places to care for the sick. Yeah, Kim.
I think most of the churches in Rome churches like the church that met
with the at least as early as 50, I think that was probably the case. They met in homes.
I suspect that most of them were met in people's homes.
Yeah. If you look at the archaeology of Rome or Jerusalem or any major city, you don't see large public spaces. You see open-air public spaces, but you don't see enclosed public spaces. They probably met in people's workspaces, because a couple like Aquila and Priscilla, they're tent makers, okay? So they're going to have some space that's large enough that they can work on things in their workspace. Most Roman houses didn't have kitchens. You went down to the public market, you bought food, and you ate it at the public market. You didn't necessarily take food back to your houses. They definitely didn't have bathrooms, they had public bathrooms. Some of the wealthy people had kitchens in their homes. Some had bathrooms in their home, but for the most part, your home was a place where you slept, and then other activities tended to be carried out more in public spaces. So my conclusion is that they probably met in Aquila and Priscilla's warehouse, or probably it would have been on the, if we learned anything from archaeology, that was probably on the first floor and you lived on the second floor. So yeah, they were meeting in their home, in their house. But that's going to restrict the number of people that can be a part of that group. Because most of these public spaces wouldn't seat 100 people. Now, a wealthy individual might have had a home that incorporated a loggia or like an open air patio. A lot of the homes of the wealthy were built kind of in a circle, and all of the rooms opened into this central court. So that would seat more people. But most probably these were just working folk, and they hosted the church in their warehouse. And I met with a church in what was the name of that lake in California that was close to us when we lived in Brea? Can't remember the name of the lake. Lake Elsinore. There was a church in Lake Elsinore, and one of the members of that church was a doctor, so they met in his office. That was where they met. That was the biggest place that they had available to them. So the church is probably made up largely of Gentiles. And part of the reason that I say that is because if you read the 16th chapter, most of the people that he mentions by name have Gentile names. Now, it may have been a case like Saul, who had a Jewish name, Saul, and a Gentile name, Paul. But I think most of the Christians in Jerusalem were probably Gentiles. And that's one of the reasons. Paul included those people in Rome as a part of his work among the Gentiles. Even though he hadn't preached the gospel there, he didn't talk about them as being Jews. He talked about them as being a part of the Gentile world. He wants to have some fruit among them as he does among the other Gentiles, generally speaking. Paul converted Jews, no doubt, but he also converted a lot of Gentiles. And he, in the first chapter, verse 14, remember he says, I wrote to you boldly. That's because I'm the minister to the Gentiles. So I think that's why he wrote that. So what was Paul's intention, at least as far as the Roman saints were concerned? This is the most complete presentation of the gospel that the apostle wrote. And it's far reaching. It takes the whole gospel. Whereas Hebrews, and I don't think Paul wrote Hebrews, because Hebrews is written mostly to the Jews. It's the same kind of letter. It's this broad essay that lays out the gospel. It's not like 1 Corinthians. The reason that Paul wrote 1 Corinthians was because some folks in Corinth had talked to him and told him about some problems they were having in Corinth. So that's why he wrote 1 Corinthians. And the book of 1 Corinthians doesn't lay out the gospel in an organized fashion from start to finish. It just deals with problems. And if you go through 1 Corinthians, it seems like it's one problem right after another, right after another, right after another. And he deals with all of those problems. Now, ultimately, that concerns the gospel, but it's just not like the book of Romans. The book of Romans is a masterful treatise where Paul lays out the Christian's walk. And I think that's what we'll see. Now, remember we said when we looked at the map, Paul had spent most of his time over here on the eastern side of the Mediterranean. Now he wants to go to Spain. It's not going to help him that Antioch is over here on the eastern side of the Mediterranean, and that's been his kind of his base of operations. It's like he needs a new base of operations for his western missionary journeys. And so I think that's what's going on. He's trying to establish this new base of operations. And in order to do that, you have to make sure that those folks have the whole gospel laid out. They have to be grounded in the whole thing. I read a statement as I was preparing for this, and for the life of me, I can't remember where I read it now. I read a bunch of stuff. I can't remember where I read it now, but the statement that I read was, people that are not very well grounded in the entirety of the gospel spend all of their time talking about the forgiveness of sins. Because that's all they know. So you've got to get beyond that. You've got to expand it. And that's what the writer of the book of Hebrews says. When for the time you ought to be teachers, you have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God. So we're going to lay aside the doctrine of baptism. We're not going to talk about that. You need to talk about the fuller understanding if you're going to be helpful to me preaching over in Spain. So I think that's one of the keys to understanding why Paul would write this letter, and it's a marvelous letter. It's just incredible in its breadth and in its logic. So I think that's why he's done that. Now, it's true that Paul had been misrepresented by a lot of folks. You know, it seemed like a lot of folks said, Paul, you're talking about grace, and every time you talk about grace, people get the impression that they can go around sinning. You got to stop just talking about grace. Okay? And Paul, he wants to write not necessarily to argue with those folks. He mentions it. He wants to write so that the people that he's writing to have a broad understanding. He doesn't treat this as the purpose of his writing. I had a friend one time that said, sometimes we write to be understood. Sometimes we write so that we won't be misunderstood. And those are two very different things. And I think what Paul is doing here is he's writing so that he'll be understood. And of course, you know, he's along the way, he's going to mention some things that people have said about him, but that's not his real purpose. His real purpose is to give them a complete understanding. Now, yeah, Phil.
Something here I don't really understand. In 1:11.
Okay.
It says he wants to come to impart some spiritual gift for their establishment. What spiritual gift is going to establish?
Well, that could be understood in a number of different ways. It could be that he wanted to go there and impart a miraculous gift that would help them. That's a possibility. It could be that he wanted to go there and just make sure that they had a full understanding of the gospel, and that would be the gift. And that would establish them. On Sunday morning, we're going to talk about how not understanding something completely produces a shaky faith. So we'll talk about Mark 16 and the women that came to the tomb. And they saw that the tomb was empty, and then the record says they were afraid. And that's really interesting. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. So he wants to make sure, good point, that they're established. Maybe it was a spiritual gift, but remember he talks about that he also wants to be, he says he wants to, and let me find it. You're right, verse 11, he wants to impart some spiritual gift to them. And then in verse 12, he says, that is, that I with you may be comforted in you, each of us, by the other's faith, both yours and mine. So I think they were going to impart a gift to him as well. And it could just be their steadfastness. That could mean that they were going to impart some gift to him in helping him go to Spain. Could be, you know, that they were going to financially support him so that he could go to Spain. Yeah.
There's something that I see here, and having heard a lot of preachers in my life since I was a teenager, and see the different perspectives and the different techniques that people used to teach, then they're all teaching the truth. And this is something it takes years to learn and to absorb as part of yourself. But in the beginning, and today, for young Christians who don't know anything except salvation, that's the love of the love for each other makes someone hang on until they learn.
That's true. That's true.
And it's not, love is not the be all and the end all, but it's an absolutely necessary part of our faith, the church.
And you know, I think you demonstrate that most appropriately by understanding that what happens in a class like this, I benefit greatly from what you bring to this class. And hopefully I bring something to this class. We benefit each other. This is not the expert in the front of the room. Okay? When I taught statistics, I was the expert. I didn't expect to get much input from people in my statistics classes, especially from undergraduates. They were learning brand new things that they had never learned before. Okay? At that point, I was the chump in the front of the room. And it was just a lecture. It had to be, because I was the only one that in the room at that point that knew what I was talking about. I don't see that as happening with the apostle. He's not going there to say, I'm going to tell you how it is. He was going to get something from them as well. So, a man who clearly had an understanding that was beyond what most people had, a man like Paul, wanted to be benefited by going to Jerusalem and having them impart to him some spiritual gift.
There's something there. Paul His early established personality, where we see right before his conversion, was to me kind of a hateful persona. And he's learning a new way to be, trying to leave that.
Well, he managed to do it beautifully. I wish I could do it as well as he did. Yeah, Faye.
In chapter 15, we read something interesting. It says, so that I may come to you in joy by the will of God and find refreshing rest in your
company. Okay.
The phrase, you visit a congregation. Since you have heard about who you go,
that's a good point. And to that point, when Paul was in Athens, you remember he said he had no rest in his spirit. His spirit was troubled. So he went looking for Timothy because he needed Timothy. And I think that's the position that we all want to be in. I need you, and hopefully I can impart something to you, and you impart something to me. I have said it before. Sometimes I get tired being the person who stands in the front all the time, and sometimes I just want to go sit down under a tree in the shade and have somebody else stand up in front. And I'm tired. I need to rest. And Jesus oftentimes had to retreat away from the crowds. And the problem with Jesus is he's going to have a really hard time finding somebody who is his equal, who can refresh him. What were you going to say? Yeah, there's nobody. So Jesus says, I want to go over here and sit down under a tree and have you teach for a little while. Who's he going to get to do that? He can't. So I see something very important in the Apostle Paul. Remember, he went to Jerusalem. He laid out his gospel in Galatians 2. That was it's not all recorded for us. He just laid it out. And here is where he lays out what he's been teaching to the Gentiles. And it's the gospel. It's from beginning to end. It's everything about the gospel. And remember, most of it is not about what you do when you come together to take the Lord's Supper. Most of it is service, not necessarily just worship. Okay. Boy, we made it through all of that. Go ahead.
And for the staff, does that just mean that they work? Because I know what I'm thinking, but I'm not.
Okay. The way I would understand established is you have faith, okay? And the way to really make you strong, to establish you, is to give you a broader understanding. To give you more knowledge about God. And that's what's going to establish you.
But wasn't he talking about the family and the church?
I'm sorry, something happened tonight.
Wasn't he talking about the people at the meeting and the church?
Yes. Yeah. They had faith. And it had sounded out. And it, remember, he said, I always give thanks to God because of your faith. They had faith. But your faith keeps getting stronger and stronger the more you understand. And I think that's what he's talking about. Yeah, Bob.
My particular New American Standard, it uses the word encourage.
Okay.
They encourage each other.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's a good, that's a very good translation. And the thing that makes you strong is more understanding. I hope Sunday morning will make that better. I'm going to preach my whole sermon if I'm not careful before I get to Sunday. Then I won't have anything to say. Let me hold that off until Sunday. But if you want to spend some time reading, read Mark 16, verses 1 through 9. And just be aware that in a lot of manuscripts, that's where Mark ends. That's a little shocking that that's the way it would end. But just put yourself in the position of those women and what they had seen. And it's as if it was, they had some faith, but it got a lot stronger later. Okay. Other comments? Anybody at home have comments?